and we came to the end of Jetson Coffee's Vinayak teachings. I thought it would be good for dessert to do a thing called Lamrim. Hey, Lamrim is good in that it's like grounding yourself. I think, you know, the idea of this class is that it's a 5-year course, or I don't know how many years it's going to be, but the idea is that you could learn to translate or to become a teacher of Buddhism, and it's good every once in a while to go back and ground yourself in Lamrim. Lamrim is like the basis of everything, and we'll talk about its benefits tonight, but it's important, I think, that as we go through the whole process, that you go back to Lamrim every once in a while. Lamrim keeps your, especially your motivation in the right place, and it gives you also a view of the whole Buddhist teachings. So I thought every few courses we should go back to Lamrim. Okay? Lam means path, and Rim means the steps along the path. Okay? Buddhist teaching is like a big, I like to compare it to an automobile engine, and you can open up the hoods of various cars, and especially if you're like me and you don't know anything about engines much, they all look the same, you know? I mean, you look in and there's a little bit of difference, but you look in and it looks like an engine, and then you get behind the wheel and you put the key in and you turn it, and then sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. When it doesn't work, it means that something big is missing. You know, like a battery or like a carburetor you can do without almost. It'll go for a while and you can get to where you're going. Or like certain kinds of filters, like the car won't break down. It'll still go someplace for a while. Pistons, I once took apart a Volkswagen and wrecked one of the pistons and they still work. You can run on 3 or 5 pistons. It doesn't go very fast, but you can get there. And in other cars, you can open it up and everything looks normal, but something really important is missing, and the thing doesn't work at all. Lamrim is like that. Lamrim is a presentation of all the steps that you need to get to Buddhahood. And it's a specific number of steps. It's just like a car engine. If any one of the major steps is missing, you can't get to Buddhahood. If you have all the essential steps, but you don't have like all these accessories, it'll still get there. So it's important to know what Lamrims are really. By the way, Lamrim refers to the whole kind of literature called Lamrim, and the whole idea of a teaching where you get all the parts in one teaching, but also each separate step is called Lamrim, a Lamrim. So the Lamrim teachings have maybe 10, 20, 30 Lamrims inside, meaning steps that you must have. So sometimes they say this is a Lamrim, meaning one part of the whole Lamrim. So you got to watch out for that. Sometimes Lamrim means the whole presentation on the steps of the path to Buddhahood, which means the whole engine. And sometimes when you're talking about a certain kind of meditation like death meditation, that's a Lamrim, meaning one of the steps that you need to have. So it's important once in a while to go back and find out and review just the essential structure of Buddhism, what you need to know. If you go through the whole monastic course, which is the idea of this 5-year program, you start out in the monastery doing perfection of wisdom. You do that for 12 years. Then you do supplemental topics of the perfection of wisdom. It might take you another 3 or 4 years. Sometimes it's included in the 12 years. Then you do Majjhimika. That's 2 years. Then you do Abhidharma. That's 2 years. Then you do Vinaya, 2 years. And you have about 8 years of Pramana, which is logic, Tema. And then as you get towards the end of the whole course, you begin to see the structure of Buddhism. It's very interesting. As you get towards the last 3-4 years, you know, up till then it's all this great mass of things to learn, you know, and you keep going and going and going, debating and debating and debating, and you don't really see a lot of tie-in with the other subjects. You would think like Buddhist logic ethics, perceptual theory, psychology, cosmology, and how do you know, things like that, epistemology. Those are all, they all seem like much different subjects, but then somewhere around the 15th year or something, you finally get it, and you see how everything is one huge interconnected spider web, you know, and how everything forms a huge network of light, like I like to think of it as a big sphere, and each of the different subjects is like a point of light on the sphere, and in together they all make one of these AT&T, you know, spheres, you know, and it really is like that, but you don't get it till about the 15th year, and then you finally see the structure of the whole thing. You see how, like, Buddhist logic relates directly to seeing emptiness, and you see how psychology relates directly to karma, and you begin to see how past lives relate directly to a teaching on something that would seem completely unrelated, and suddenly you see how everything connects with everything else. That's like a long rim realization. You can either go to the monastery for 15 or 18 years, or you can study long rim. Long rim is like prepackaged fast food, you know, and you can get the whole structure, the whole vision that takes, you know, almost 15, 16, 17 years to get in the monastery. You can get that whole vision by studying one good long rim. And that's the point of the long rim. It was revived by Atisha, and we'll talk about the history of it. It was taught by the Buddha. The idea was taught by the Buddha in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And then it was carried down through the centuries. So I'm going to go over a very brief long rim, like three classes worth. This is known as the brief long rim also. Its name is the brief long rim. Say long rim.
Lam rim.
Du din.
Lam rim.
Lam rim means lam rim. Steps on the path. Steps of the path. And then du din means very, very brief. Brief presentation. Okay? A brief presentation on the steps of the path. It was written by. You tell me. Okay? Written by Jetsun Kapa, 1357-1490. Jetsun Kapa wrote about 10,000 pages of Buddhist commentary, and I think I've mentioned it many times, but in the monastery we study maybe a few hundred pages of that. For example, in the winter debates we study a commentary on some of his work by one of his disciples. That commentary, the first chapter is maybe 100 pages long. It takes 8 years to get through the first chapter. It takes almost a month to go over about 10 pages of it. I mean, you can debate for about a month one small section from the first chapter. This is the Pramanavartika commentary by Gelta Jay. So, like, the last two chapters nobody's gotten to in recent history. I mean, someone just wrote a commentary on it, my teacher in the monastery. And it was a big event, you know, everybody was really happy, because no one has really gotten to the third or fourth chapters in recent history. Jetsun Kapa wrote 10,000 pages of text on commentaries like that. I mean, for him it was like a hot knife cutting through butter. And he just perceived these things absolutely, perfectly, quickly, and he just wrote 10,000 pages of commentary. You could spend a month on 30 of them, 40 of them. You could never, ever master all of them. You could never even read all of them. And here's this person who didn't spend much time writing. He spent most of his time in meditation. He was a great tantric master, very secret about it. And he spent a lot of his time communing with his lamas, including Manjushri. But in his free time, he was composing these scriptures. He also founded the great monasteries of Tibet, Ganden. He founded himself. Sera Dibung was founded by his disciples. Dashi Humbo by his disciple, the first Dalai Lama. Like that. That was in his free time, you know. So how he did it is incredible. But basically, he wrote his great Lam Rim is supposed, I would say most people agree, it's the greatest Buddhist scripture ever written in the Tibetan language and the greatest piece of literature in the Tibetan language. That's 1,000 pages long. He wrote a medium-sized Lamrim. I think it's a couple hundred pages long. He wrote some briefer Lamrims, and then he wrote this very, very brief Lamrim. The other Lamrims that he wrote are very, very detailed, very scholarly, very deep. Lamrim Chamo, no one has translated it well yet. It means people are still waiting for someone to translate it. It's extraordinary. And then only once in his life he wrote a Lamrim based on his own personal experiences. The other Lamrims are mostly collections of things that came before him. He collected the knowledge from ancient India. He organized it in a Lamrim, and that was very famous for that. But only on one occasion he said he took all his own experiences and put them into Lamrim. And you won't find quotations in this Lamrim. He's not quoting other people. He's actually giving it from his own experience. And that's the Lamrim Vidur. So it's very cool. I mean, oftentimes in Tibet, it's the first thing a Lama will teach you. It's the very first thing a Lama will do is teach you the Lamrim Vidur, just so you have it in your mind. This song of personal experience. So sometimes it's called the song of my spiritual life. And I give that to you. You know you're doing something important if the demons come and try to interrupt it. If everything's peaceful, then you know it's not going very well. Say J.
J.
Nyamgur.
J.
J. Nyamgur. J means of J, meaning of the Lord. Okay, the Lord. J means the Lord. What's a Doje? Yeah, the Lord of Stones. Do means stone, J means Lord, and that's a diamond. So J means Lord. Nyam means personal experience. And Gur means a song. Gur means a song. So this book is the Lamrim Vidur, which we're about to study, is also known as J Nyamgur, which is the song of my spiritual life. And he actually recounts the important events in his own spiritual life. At the beginning of the Lamrim, you try to show how it's coming directly from the Buddha. And you try to summarize it and show how the lineage came down to you. We consider it very important in Buddhism that what you're learning is it's not only a bunch of books that have been passed down from person to person. It's actual experiences and actual blessing of a human being teaching a human being. And that blessing coming down through the centuries from person to person. It's not just that the books were handed down one by one. The knowledge itself and the blessing of the knowledge that can only be transmitted from one person to another in live, which is, I'm a little bit worried about the correspondence, of course. It has to be from heart to heart. You know, it has to be a knowledge has to go from one person to the next person. So we think it's important that you have to show where that lineage comes from. If it is ever broken, then it will die in this world. People have to continue to. You have to be a receptacle, and then the Lama comes and pours water into you, and then you keep that water, and then you go and pour it into the next person that you teach, and then the water has to be poured on from heart to heart like that. It's important to show how that lineage has not been broken. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that might be one of the components to differentiate
between the two terms. Yeah. So we'll show how it comes down from person to person. Starts with who?
Buddha,
okay. I mean in this planet, okay. Say Shakya?
Shakya.
Tupa.
Tupa.
Shakya?
Shakya.
Tupa.
Tupa.
Shakya, a lot of people confuse it with Sakya, okay? Sakya is it's actually a place in Tibet that means great earth, Sakya. And there was a great school of Tibetan Buddhism that grew up in that area, and it reached its peak around the 13th century, around the 1200s, and with the Sakya Pandita. And that is one of the four great traditions of Tibetan Buddhism. Shakya is a totally different thing. And sometimes they spell it like Sakya, and then they hide a little diacritic mark on top of it. And people think Sakya and Shakya are the same thing. This is Shakya. Shakya refers to a race of people that lived in India 500 BC. And the king of the Shakyas, or he was the prince, was Gautama Buddha. You know, he grew up as a prince. And the Shakya were his people. Tupa means able one, capable one. Muni. So his name is Shakyamuni. By the way, during his own time, what happened to his people, the Shakyas? Do you know? They were totally wiped out. Okay? They were totally destroyed. And he was present at the time, and this slaughter was taking place around him. And some of them came and took refuge to him physically, you know, came into his house, in his room, and tried to hide behind him or hide near him. And they were all slaughtered. He couldn't protect them. Which gives you an idea about the meaning of refuge. The meaning of refuge is not going physically and hiding behind the Buddha. It's a mental thing that you do. And it's the mental thing that protects you. It's not a physical going for refuge or something like that. The opening lines of Jeton Kapa's song of his spiritual life, I'll just say them to you and you repeat them. I'm not going to write them on the board, but they also happen to be the opening lines of his great Lamrim, the Lamrim Chimbo. So, must be important. Okay. Say, Punso, Gele, Chewe, Dumbe, Ku, Taye, Doe, Rewa, Gongwe, Sun, Malu, Shija, Chishin, Sikbe, Tu, Shakye, Sowo, Dela, Gurchakta. Okay. This is important because it describes the quality of a Buddha, and especially a Buddha's body, speech, and mind. Where did the body, speech, and mind of a Buddha come from? It's a very, very famous verse. We have to recite it all the time in the monastery. What does punzo mean? Yeah, punzo means like excellent, culmination, something like that. Punzo. Gele, gewa?
Virtues,
good deeds. Chewa. Chewa is 10 sayas. Saya is 10 booms. Boom is 10 teeth. Ti is 10 tongs. Tong is 10 gya. And a gya is 10 chus. And a chu is 10 chicks. Chick is 1. Okay? Chewa means 10 million. Okay? 10 million different virtues. Chewe tumbeku. Tumbeku means produced. Body was produced by 10 million separate virtues. Okay? And that's just a metaphor. It's actually much more than that. Okay. But anyway, a Buddha's body has been created by a certain number of virtues. And you have to get out of the mood. You know, when we were in California, we had a 10-day teaching on the Diamond Cutter Sutra. And I think people really, towards the end, they got into the mood of perceiving the production of a Buddha and a Buddha world as not being something self-existent. Meaning, it's not external forces which are creating this this Buddha and this Buddha's world, you know. It's hard in a class that we only have twice a week. But you have to get in the mood of thinking that, how do you produce a Buddha's body? I mean, where does a Buddha's body come from? First of all, your body is a reflection of your spiritual life, you know. And in fact, the body that you have now, whatever it looks like, you know, people say, what was I in my last life, you know. You can tell almost everything just from your own body. Your body is a footprint of your mental state of your past life. It's very interesting. The fact that you have a human body means that your past life was very virtuous. The fact that you are in a Dharma class means that your past life was virtuous to the extent of one person in a million. I mean, that person was extraordinarily virtuous. If it's easy for you to understand Dharma, and if you react to it well, then that person was even more virtuous. I mean, you come into a Dharma class and you have certain reactions. it means that person was extraordinarily virtuous, was an extremely fine person. If you react to Dharma with certain reactions, like if it freaks you out and you can't think of anything else and you cry every time you hear it or something like that, it's even more virtue. You know, I mean, these are indications of what you were in your past life. But since you have a body like this, and assuming no one's a tantric deity, and I don't know who is, okay? But assuming you are who you seem to be, every detail of your body is a reflection of your mental state in your past, okay? So like if I have bony arms or hands or lousy complexion or you know, if I have a bald spot or something, or if there's things about my body that I don't like, and we talked about it in the last class, these are all a production of something in my past life. If I have an office where my boss is screaming at me, if I'm surrounded by people who are, some of them are good and some of them are not good, if my world is like that, and especially if I'm in a body which is going to be destroyed by some kind of disease, which is inevitable, the kind of bodies that we have, that comes from something negative. Those things come from something negative. So your past life did a lot of good things, but didn't pull off the ultimate goal. And seriously, and that's why you're in a body like this. This body does not fit the human potential. The human potential is something totally pure, and it has the potential to become totally enlightened. And when you do, the body will reflect that. Even if you do it in this life, I mean, the point of the secret teachings is that if you reach mentally that ultimate potential in this life, then in this same life, your very body will start to change. And it will actually become a wholly different kind of body. Not, this kind of body does not reflect the ultimate potential that each one of us has. This body is a failure. This body speaks of a former failure of a person to study the secret teachings and reach the ultimate goals of Buddhism. And that's why we have a body like this. If you change the inside, the mental part and the heart, and if they become totally pure in this life, then this body will start to change. And it won't look like the way it looks now. The way it changes and the way it ends up looking have certain typical ways. And if you reach enlightenment in this life, then it has certain qualities. That life, that body will start to reflect the inner state of the mind. And that is a Buddha's body. And that's the first line of his text. So even in the first line of his text, he's saying something really, really extraordinary. Punzo gelek chewe tumbeku. You have the capacity to create virtues mentally, especially through the secret teachings, that could create a totally different body for you before you die. And in fact, you have to try. It's like a race against death. Okay, you don't know who's going to win, actually. Chewe tumbeku. That's the body of a Buddha. Taye doi rewa kongesu. Taye doi means limitless numbers of beings. Rewa means their hopes. Kongesu means what that Buddha teaches fulfills the hopes of limitless number of beings. And this is the idea, even if what I just said is true, you know, if what I just said about the Buddha's body is true, then the kind of person who came into this world and taught that for the first time, how to get into a body like that, how to reach a body like that, those words have the capacity to fulfill the ultimate hopes of every living creature on this planet. You know, if they could listen and understand to what that person's saying, they could escape that thing called death. They would not have to die in a body like this. And that's rewa kongesu. Those are words which fulfill your hopes. You know, so that's the second quality of a Buddha. The Buddha knows how to convey the way to get out of this defective end here. Rewa kongesu. Okay. Then malu sheja jishin sipetu. Malu sheja jishin sipetu means the quality of that Buddha's mind is that it can see all existing objects at once. It means everything in the past, everything in the future, and everything that exists now on every single planet. And every detail, like every single thought you're having right now, or ever will have, or ever did have, a Buddha can see at this one moment. The Buddha sees all of those objects in one moment.
Simultaneously.
Also, all the emptinesses of all those objects, which we cannot see. You know, if we ever do reach a point where you can see emptiness directly, you can't focus on other objects. They are totally different realities. The Buddha's vision can encompass both realities simultaneously. Sees all those objects simultaneously. What drives that ability? You know, why did the Buddha get that ability? Where did it come from? What's the karma that's forcing the Buddha to see his or her own mind that way? It's compassion. It's caring for those living beings. If the person could see every existing object, if the person could see into every person's mind, and if that person could see the future of each person in this room as clearly as you see this pen, then they would know exactly what to say to you and how to move you along. So it's that motivation they have. The motivation is that they could look into your mind and see what you need at any given moment to push you along as quickly as possible to getting to a better life and mind, body and mind, before you die. I mean, that's... The Shakyatupa was one of the only Buddhas in history who taught Tantra. It's very rare. Not all Buddhas teach the secret teachings. I mean, it's extremely rare. I mean, Buddhas are extremely rare. You know how long it takes a Buddha to get to be a Buddha. Among those, there's only very few that teach the secret teachings. There's only very few worlds and very few planets and very few kinds of beings who can learn them, who can relate to them. And you have that capacity. Most people have that capacity. If it's cultivated to the right way, you can enter those teachings. And in this life, you can reach those goals. So that's the Buddha's mind has the ability to recognize those beings and then to give them exactly the right teachings at the right time to push them into that and get them to do that before they die. Shakyato de la gochakta. Shakyato means Shakyamuni. De la gochakta means Tsongkhapa at the very beginning of his text is saying, you know, I'm so lucky I met a Buddha like you. I mean, a lot of his writing is like love letters to Buddha, you know. He wrote a very famous Dendo Thupa. It's a love letter to the Buddha, Shakyamuni, because, not because he's so sexy, you know, it's because he taught dependent origination, you know, like, oh man, you're so, why do I love you so? Oh, you taught dependent origination, you know. And it's a whole beautiful book on emptiness. It's an incredible book on emptiness, but it's this love letter to Shakyamuni. It's very weird to read a lama writing, it feels just like a love letter to Shakyamuni Buddha. I mean, we kind of see Shakyamuni Buddha as this ancient historical figure, you know, with the weird head and everything, and sits strange and seems very cold, and you know, and here to Tsongkhapa, Shakyamuni Buddha is like a girlfriend or something. And really, and when you read it, it's like somebody gushing about their lover, you know. It's something. It's really beautiful. It's really touching. So you get this feeling of Shakyamuni Buddha being a real, you know, being who's there waiting for you and loving you and waiting for you to be able to see him and like that. It's very, very beautiful. So Shakyatupa is the beginning of the lineage of the Lama. This is where it all starts. And those are the qualities of the Buddha that come down to the lineage and are transmitted to the lineage. Yeah. How a Buddha teaches is really beautiful. And they teach, they has 60 different qualities. The most famous of the 60 is that no matter what language they speak Sanskrit. But as they speak Sanskrit, each being hears their own language, including other beings. So they do teach in other realms, but very rarely, because they cannot relate to a Buddha. They can't hear a Buddha. You know, like in the hell realm, it's pretty famous that we don't, in our tradition, ever, and it is not in the Vinaya, any custom of drawing the Buddha in the hell realm in the Wheel of Life, for example. There are Wheel of Life paintings that you'll see where the Buddha is, you know, it looks like he's teaching in the hell realm. And we think that's really inauspicious. You know, he's outside of the whole circle. He's standing outside because he's not in there anymore. And they say, well, he's compassionate, so he's taking birth into hell to help those beings. But in the Abhidharma and all the scriptures, it says, your mind is, you know, just imagine, Nagarjuna says, imagine someone stripping you naked, tying you to a pole, and like 1,000 people running at you and stabbing spears into your body. And your whole existence in the hell is spent with that kind of feeling. He says much greater pain than that. So you can't even frame a thought in hell. You can't frame a thought, a straight thought. You cannot. You can't have a straight thought in hell. Just suffering, just pain, agony. And so they can't like consider the benefits of Dharma or something like that. There's no such thought. No being in the hell realms is able to frame a thought like that. They're just suffering. And animals cannot normally frame a straight thought either. Their minds are like water compared to cream or something, you know. They can't hold up a straight thought. They're just mainly running on instinct and trying to prevent themselves from being eaten. And that's their main life. That's their whole... And in pretas you can't see them, but they're just consumed by the search of food and drink. Their whole life is spent trying to search for food and drink. You can't study Dharma if you're starving, you know, or you can't get something to drink. And then beings in the deity realms are like people in the East Village enjoying a cafe outside at night. And if you could enjoy a nice cafe on a wonderful fall day, you know, all evening with good friends and beautiful friends, people, you know, it'd be very hard to think about a Dharma class, extremely hard. But they're even more extreme. I mean, their experiences are even more extreme. So they can't do it. So they do try. And there have been instances where Buddha's taught in other realms, but very difficult. And there's this beautiful presentation in the Prajnaparamita of all the different ways in which they can teach, like a wind blowing through a tree, or like a flower just opening up for you and teaching you something. I mean, Buddhas are not restricted to the Chokitukku, which means the ultimate Nimanakaya. They have all these other Nimanakayas that, you know, it's not impossible at all for a wave, for the moonlight on a wave and on the beach at night to be an emanation of the Buddha and teaching you something as the wave rolls and as those little diamonds sprinkle through the wave, you know. There's something, it's quite possible that that's an emanation of the Buddha and that there's something they're teaching you right then. It's not impossible at all. And there's this beautiful, you know, outline of all the different bodies they can emanate. It's really cool. And there's names for all of them, and we'll study it someday. Okay. So by the way, in the homework, you're going to have 5 of these. That's level number 1. That's great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, okay? Say Jetson.
Jetson.
Champa.
Jetson.
Jetson.
Champa.
In Sanskrit, Maitreya. And Champa and Maitreya means love. Champa is, in fact, a special kind of love. There's 2 kinds of love in Buddhism. One where you want to remove people's suffering, and the other where you want to give people a good time. This is the second kind. This is the kind where you want people to reach nice things. The other kind of love is the kind that wants to remove all the suffering of beings. But Jampa is the kind that, it's like a party love. And it wants to spread happiness. It's like this very Santa Claus kind of love, you know. And wants to give things to people. Wants to make people happy. That's Jampa. You met him out in New Jersey, right? And then Jambe Yang is Manjushri. Also called Manju Gosha. Jambe Yang means Manju Gosha. And Jambel means Manjushri. Jampa means very gentle and soft. And Yang means... Yang is a beautiful word that means like a melody or a song. So sometimes we call him gentle voice. Jetsun Jampa, Maitreya has another name, which is Mipam. Mipam meaning undefeatable. The undefeatable one. So sometimes you see Mipam. I used to get really, really confused about these 2 dudes, okay? You read sutras and they are bodhisattvas and they are studying with the Buddha and the Buddha is teaching them and they are involved in all these wonderful events around the historical Buddha. And then you read other scriptures and there's this guy named Maitreya in a Buddha paradise teaching a Sangha, and who's going to come as the next Buddha. And then you get really confused, you know. And then sometimes they say Maitreya is a Buddha, and sometimes they say he's not a Buddha yet. And then sometimes, but then you look in the Tengyur, his works are in the commentaries. They're not in the Kangyur. Kangyur is the books that are spoken by an enlightened being. And then you find Maitreya's books in the Tengyur, which means he's not enlightened yet. These are the commentaries by unenlightened beings. And you get really confused. You're wondering, who are these guys, really? You know. And then in the monastery, this was my pre-geshi debate. You do two pre-geshi debates. It's like you have to pass BA, then MA, and then geshi. And the debate for the pre-geshi is sometimes there's a debate about Jhampa. You know, is he a bodhisattva or is he a Buddha? And it's a huge debate. It's a great debate. The bottom line is, do I tell you or not? The bottom line in the secret teaching, okay, is that he is already a Buddha, okay, and the same for Manjushri. And in fact, there are branches of the secret teachings devoted to these two beings. You have to have initiation, and then you get a special instructions on how to meet them and how to get to their level. So that's really the highest interpretation. Okay? In the secret teachings, they are already Buddhas, and they are masquerading as bodhisattvas. They have come to this planet. They are pretending to be plain old students of the Buddha, and they are asking stupid questions of the Buddha. And the Buddha is pretending to give them enlightening answers. And then the Buddha is teaching sutras and tantras. Because these two bodhisattvas are asking him questions and their situations and like that. But in the ultimate interpretation, they've been enlightened a long time, and they are total Buddhas who are pretending to be bodhisattvas. And that's why the confusion. Okay. You can boil down all of Buddhism into two things. I mean, if you really had only 5 minutes to tell somebody about Buddhism, then all you'd have to tell them would take about 2 minutes, which would be all you really need is two different things. I mean, you need the bodhisattva ideal. Okay? On one hand, you need the bodhisattva ideal, which is, I'm in the mood because I'm going to do it tomorrow night at the Open Center. I've been reading this mental training, right? And it's this crazy bodhisattva wisdom. You know, I don't know what to call it, but it's bodhisattva behavior, which is according to the world crazy. You know, which is like just spending your whole life thinking about other people, like Jhampa out in New Jersey. You know, like, can I give you another tea? You know, and just totally thinking about the other person all the time. You know, and forgetting about yourself and dedicating your whole life to taking care of other people and watching out for what other people need and thinking only about other people. And it's a great, great, great medicine to the mind. I mean, the more you can do it, the happier you are. It's just automatic happiness. Automatic instant happiness. You know, forget about yourself and dedicate yourself to other people and watch out and give up the things you want. Make sure everyone around you is happy. Make sure everyone gets exactly what they want. You know, spend your whole life acting like that. And it's instant happiness. It's instant gratification, you know. It's really cool. I mean, that's 50% of Buddhism. It's a bodhisattva behavior. And it's totally unnatural for human beings. You have to get into it. And you have to learn about it. And if you had only 5 minutes to teach somebody, you would really want to press on them this cool behavior called bodhisattva behavior and how happy it would make them. You know, immediately, if they would just break through that obstacle of thinking about themselves, just think about other people. That's bodhisattva behavior. And in Buddhism, that great branch is represented by Maitreya. There's a code word for it, and I don't know what you want to call it. I mean, it means like, you know, like that. I don't know. It's called Gyachen Chöpa. I don't know how to... It means like, you know... Just something, I don't know. It's like Gatien. It's Gatien. It's like United States, you know, big or something. Why? It's widespread, literally, but I don't think it gives the meaning. Maybe you can come up with a better word. It's just this Santa Claus, giving of your whole heart, you know. But the word in Tibetan is vast, or something like that. Something like vast behavior, but I don't think it really. It's vast giving behavior. Okay, call it vast giving behavior. I don't know. You know, we need a consultant. But it's just some kind of very, very, I don't know, generous heart, wide-spreading heart that just goes out and spreads all over everybody and gives them everything. That's Gyatso Chöpa. And that's this whole wing of Buddhism represented by Maitreya. It's that. Okay. And then on the other side, you must have what we call the vision of emptiness. And that's the other great wing of Buddhism. And you know, you meet people who only have bodhisattva behavior. They are very, very generous and compassionate and giving, and it overflows with you, you know. You feel it, you sense it. They are very, very generous people. But they lack the knowledge of emptiness. Emptiness is a very, very special idea. It did not reach it to the east, to the west, I think. In our spiritual development of the Western world, I don't believe, I mean, as I know from my spiritual development as a child, you know, going to church, and I loved church, and I loved all the things that they taught. But I think you'll maybe agree that the, what we call the explicit teachings on emptiness, where somebody actually sits down and explains it in detail, are missing. We don't have it. It's some like great gap in the Western spiritual life. You can say that maybe it's been implied in different traditions, or maybe it's been experimented with in different traditions. But what we call the explicit, outright, clear, detailed presentation of emptiness, I think is a lack. And like you could be, if you're a very, very good person in the Western spiritual sense, you can be this giving person, you know, this vast giving mind, you know, and you can do that. But I believe, I mean, personally, what I found in Buddhism that most helped me, that I felt a lack of before, was this understanding of emptiness. I mean, and together they are an unbeatable combination. Buddhism is saying that if you only had 5 minutes to explain to somebody the essence of Buddhism, it would be these two ideas. I mean, one is, just give up living for yourself and start to live for others, and then understand emptiness at the same time. As you live for others, and as you go through that crazy bodhisattva behavior of just taking care of other people first, do it with an understanding of emptiness. And then the results are like gasoline and fire. You know, I mean, then the results are explosive. The results are something extraordinary. And either one by itself, I mean, you also meet people who intellectually have spent much of their life on the concept of emptiness, but you can feel a real dryness in them because they don't have this, you know, and you can sense it and you smell it, and you can sense what it would be if you had that without that. And in fact, Chandrakirti, I mean, he gets into this huge thing of Buddhism is like this great, beautiful bird. And these two wings are like the two wings of the bird. And if you took one wing and broke it, if you broke the bone and the bone was sticking out, you know, then what, the bird would be useless. I mean, the bird could walk around maybe, but couldn't soar and couldn't go to the moon or whatever, you know. He says you need both of them. You have to have both sides. So obviously Manjushri knew about love and taught a lot about love, but the essence, the emphasis of Manjushri's lineage is emptiness. And the essence of my trans lineage is love. Yeah. There are like thousands of beings like this who are masquerading as bodhisattvas in the Buddhist time. And Avalokiteshvara is another one, and who's really a tantric deity. And each of them has their own specialty. You know, and for Chenrai Sikh, for Avalokiteshvara, it's also compassion. It's Nyingje, which is the other form of love that I talked about, which is the love which wishes to remove suffering from the object, like a mother who wants to, the child is cutting itself with a knife or something, and you want to get the knife away or something. That's Avalokiteshvara. And each one, there's hundreds, and they form the four great classes of Tantra. And they each have their own place in one of the four great classes of Tantra. And you have to study them. And you have to meet them. And you have to become them. That's another story. Yeah?
Is it related to what we were talking about last week when we were saying that somebody who has the absence of places, you know, and that they're in a place of total peace, they're able to empathize with somebody else's sadness, but it doesn't upset them to the point where they're knocked out of that vision, that peace.
Yeah.
So I would think that what you're saying here, correct me, that you can't really have that true benevolence, that true generosity, unless you're in a place where, you know, you have your own, you know, stuff together, as they say.
Yeah.
You know? And so it has to happen simultaneously, because if you're in the state of peace and tranquility,
then
of course you can give in this, you know, very benevolent way. So it's simultaneous. Otherwise, you're just doing it because you want to be nice.
Yeah, so that's how it starts. But that's in the time of the Buddha, 500 BC. Then historically, there's a point at which there comes a being who's not a Buddha, okay, and who comes into this world, and the function, you know, their job of coming into this planet is to begin the process of explaining what these people said to other people. You know, these are called the Shingde Suje. Shing means word. Da means horse. What's a Shingda? A wooden horse, which means a carriage, a wagon. Okay? Which was a big deal in ancient India. I mean, whoever thought up the first wagon was really smart. And if you look at the Indian wagons, even nowadays, they're extremely simple and extremely efficient. They're like a work of art. They're a wonder. You know, I mean, they haven't changed, I don't know how many thousand years, but they're just cool. They work extremely well. They're made with simple things. And they get people and things all over India. And they're still the same as they did a thousand years, but nothing has changed. And just, they're so cool, and they're all made of wood, and there's nothing fancy, and it just works. That's a Shingda. Suje means the person who thought it up. Okay, the person who introduced this idea for the first time. So historically, this is an expression in the Prajnaparamita, and it's used to describe two beings who came into this planet and thought up a way to present this information and give it to people in a presentation that they could follow in a more easy way. If you try to study the sutras, forget it. You know, I mean, if you go and try to read sutras, forget it. It will go over your head. You won't get anything out of it. I mean, you could study Tibetan. By the way, if you study Tibetan, this Tibetan, you can read sutras. Tibetan has not changed in a thousand years. If you can read a newspaper and you can read the early sutras, the same. Tibetan has not changed. The Tibetan that you're learning, you can use to debate in modern Tibetan, and you can use it to read ancient sutras. Same thing. But if you read those sutras, it'll go. You'll say, "I don't get it." You know, it's deep. So you have to have these commentators. These are the two great commentators that came into this planet, and usually there's only one for each side of the lineage. There's only one. Okay. On this side, it's Nagarjuna. On the emptiness side. Did Nagarjuna teach about love? Of course. Well, but what did he emphasize? You know, what did he teach explicitly? What was his explicit teachings? Mostly on emptiness. Okay. And now over here is a sangha. They're called Zanling Genyi, the two jewels in our planet. They're like precious jewels who appeared in this planet. And they begin the commentarial tradition. They begin the process of explaining in words that we can understand. As your Tibetan gets better, you'll find that you can't understand what they wrote either. And you have to read the early Indian commentaries, which come, they go from about the 6th century to the 9th century. And you'll try to read those and you won't be able to understand those either. And then you go to the Kadampa reading, the writings, and they're very brief and very deep, and you won't be able to understand those either. And then you go up to Bhutan Rinpoche's time, just before Tsongkhapa, and to the great Sakya Kagyu masters before Tsongkhapa, and you won't be able to understand them either. And then you get into Tsongkhapa in 1357, and you can read that too, but you won't be able to understand him either. And then you'll read the commentaries by the first Dalai Lama and by his Gyaltsa Jayakadabje, by his disciples, and they are deep, and you cannot get them. And then you go to these, to the monastic textbooks written by Chönin Dapa Shedu, people like that, by Chönin Lama, and you begin to read the textbooks that were written in the 1800s, the 1700s, and you can understand those if you have a good teacher. So you have to work backwards, and it's very, very cool. You learn the monastic textbooks. They open up Tsongkhapa's era, which opens up the great early Sakya Kagyu masters, which opens up the first Indians who came to Tibet, which opens up the earlier Indians, which opens up Nagarjuna Sangha, which opens up the sutras. And it's just like doors opening, you know, like that. And then you can pick up a sutra and say, oh, I get it, you know. But you have to go through that process. So that's their place. The Sangha and Nagarjuna are starting that process. They're starting to help people to understand the sutras. How many levels we got?
2, 3.
This goes up to about, there was a great Indian master named Atisha. You have his dates with you? It's 982 to 1052. Is that it? 982-1052? Yes. There's a long story about Atisha. He was studying in India. He was a great, great master. He knew about these two lineages, and he went to seek out lamas who could teach him these lineages in India, Indian pundits, great Indian masters. And he met, on the wisdom side, someone named Vidya Kokila, which you don't have to know, okay? Rigpa Kuchu in Tibetan. And this Indian Buddhist master taught him the emptiness side. Totally. Mastered it. Then he went all around India looking for someone to teach him the, you know, bodhisattva behavior side. And he could not find a person who really held the lineage perfectly. Then he heard there was somebody over in Indonesia, Sumatra, who knew, who had that lineage. And so he goes to get on a wooden sailing boat and goes 12 months journey to Sumatra, to Indonesia, and goes looking for Selingba. Seling means the golden isle. And from him he learned the bodhisattva behavior, that lineage. It's very famous that when he got there, he did not go to Serlingba. He went to check him out like a private eye. And he actually spent a long time trying to determine whether or not this was an authentic teacher. And it tells you something. You know, he spent all these years looking around India for someone. He got on a boat, went 12 months on a very dangerous sea voyage, got this Sumatra and didn't go to see Selingba. He went to he checked him out first. He spent a long time checking him out. And then finally he decided this is an authentic teacher, and he went and learned from him. So Atisha combines the two lineages for the first time in this total way after that time. And he wrote the first Lam Rim text as we know it. It's called The Lamp on the Path. Bodhipatta Pradipa. Okay. Lamp on the Path. So that's really Jetsun Kapa, you'll see in the reading, he's bowing down to each member of this lineage. And then number five, and then we'll take a break. Number five is all the lineage lamas up to you. Down to Ken Rinpoche. Okay. So if you go back in Ken Rinpoche, you can go backwards. You know, there's Ken Rinpoche, and then there's Chijan Rinpoche, and with him, Pavongkhan Rinpoche. And then you can go back. You can go back like that. You can go back to Jetsun Kapa. And from Jetsun Kapa, it's very easy to get back to Atisha, Lord Atisha. You can go back to the whole lineage. The point is this. Why does Jetsun Kapa spend 5 whole verses of his extremely short book? You know, he spends, he wastes, I mean, it looks like he's wasting 5 verses on going through this lineage. Why does he go through this lineage like that? The point is this. The point is really that you have to get in the mood of this being an unbroken lineage of wisdom, okay? Being poured from one being into the next being, and that it has not been broken. Up to the present time, up to this Holiness of Dalai Lama, up to Ken Rinpoche, up to Chijan Rinpoche, it has never been broken. This transmission of this kind of wacky behavior, where you are devoting your life to other beings. I mean, the whole idea is so unnatural for a human being. And then this, I mean, unheard of. If someone didn't mention it to you, could you ever come up with it on your own? Impossible. I mean, the point is to recognize that these are two very, very, very precious knowledges that are being passed on from being to being, and that they're very fragile in a sense, you know. I mean, how many people in this room? And how many people in this room will pass it on to another person? So it's very, very fragile. It's very, very, especially after Tibet was lost, it became extremely fragile. The connection, the thread, is in great danger at this moment. You know, it looks like we're having a nice Buddhism class on 6th Street in New York City. What's really happening is, I mean, immense historical events are being decided at this moment. You know, will the thread go on? You know, will this knowledge be passed on, especially in another culture? It's really, every person here is the next link, and it's not a small responsibility. You know, if you lose it at this point, it'll be lost forever. Essentially, I mean, I get up and give this lecture to the monks in the monastery every time I go to. You know, it looks like a lot of monks. There's 1,000 monks in Sarame. You know, it looks like a lot of monks. It's nothing. You're talking in I don't know how many billion people are. 3 billion? I don't know. What is it? 5.5 billion people. You're talking about 1,000 people holding this water. You know, holding the wisdom in their hearts. And it's very, very, very close to breaking. It's extremely dangerous right now. These are historical moments. I mean, people either look back and say, this was the days it was lost, or they'll look back and say, oh, those great Americans, you know, they did it again. You know, they did something right, and they captured Buddhism and passed it down, and it wasn't lost. I mean, according to according to the prophecies of the ancient scriptures, Buddhism will last another 2,500 years. We're only halfway through, and it will be passed on by you people. According to the prophecies, it will come to this land, and this is in the sutras, and I've shown it to people, and it's in, you know, you can read it, but it will come to this land. I mean, the story is that we succeed. Now, it doesn't mean you don't have to try, okay? But the prophecy is that it will be passed on, and it will continue for another 2,500 years. Through the Western people, it will be passed down. And this is about the time that it's supposed to be. This is exactly the time it's supposed to be transmitted. This is the time. So it's very cool. So think about it. Think about the lineage. Appreciate the lineage. And think about yourself as being a conduit through which this knowledge is. It's a historical moment, and that's it. The Lam Rim, those two great currents of wisdom are passing down through us, and we have to take care to hand it on nicely, you know, very beautifully and perfectly, and not corrupting it, and understanding it well, and passing it on. Okay, now pass on some tea and coffee, and we'll do a little bit more to Jetsun Kapa's Little Lam Rim, that was written by Chone Lama, Dr. Shigen. Okay, say Chone Lama Dakpa Shidu. I think some of you already know, but Chöni Lama Drakpa Shedrup, who lived 1675 to 1748, as I mentioned, you really do need the monastic textbooks in order to get back to the earlier books. They open a door back to the earlier books. And in our monastery, Sarah May Monastery, we have two sets of textbooks. One was written by Kirup Denpa Dargye, and then another set was written by Chöni Lama. Sometimes we just call him Chöni Lama. Those books, 12 volumes, with maybe a few hundred works in them, were closely guarded in Sarah May's library in Tibet, and we kept them very jealously. If other colleges get a hold of your textbooks, they can debate you much more effectively. So it's like carefully kept in your monastery library. That library took a direct hit by Chinese artillery in 1959, and all of those copies were destroyed. And it took us 30 years to locate another copy. We found a partial copy in Beijing. Somebody photocopied it, a really bad photocopy. And then we found a beautiful copy in St. Petersburg Library, where we have a couple of monks working to catalog those books. So you're very lucky. The commentary you have has been missing up until now. And we just discovered this about 2 years ago in St. Petersburg. So you're studying Drakpa Shedrup's commentary. His commentary is called Ningbo. Say Ningbo.
Ningbo.
Dordu. Selwa.
Ningbo.
Dordu. Selwa. Selwa means illumination, like shedding light on something. Dordu means brief, and you can see the name of Jetsun Kapa's book is there, brief. And Ningbo means the essence. So his book means the illumination of the briefer essence or something like that. Illumination of the essence. And that's the commentary you'll be studying. And that's been translated by students from the Tibetan track class. They've almost finished the whole text now. So you'll be studying the commentary that they've translated. And I think that dream of students being able to translate is, we have now 5-6 students translating commentaries and stuff. And so it's cool. Some of them thought they weren't going to be learning Tibetan. So you never know. Okay, we went through the lineage. I'm not going to answer. There's a question on the homework about why is the Lamrim like a wishing jewel and why is it like the ocean? And I'm going to leave that. You read the reading and you'll find out. Okay, I'm going to just do finally. There's four special qualities of the Lamrim teachings. I mean, the most obvious one, which is not one of the four, okay, the obvious one about having a class about Lamrim is that since the Lamrim incorporates every major Buddhist subject, you know, every part of the engine that you really, really need, then if you just have one brief class on the Lamrim, and if you cover the whole Lamrim, then you've covered all the Buddhist teachings. I mean, I can tell you that if you do one good Lamrim course, you have covered the essence of everything I can teach you in 5-6 years. You know, that's the quality of the Lamrim. So the virtue is also like that. If you go through a Lamrim, you cover every major point, and you get the virtue of going through the whole Kangyur and Tengyur, you know, 3,500 works. You can cover like that. Just in one session, in 3 nights of studying Lamrim, we will cover the essence of Buddhist teaching. You know, so it's kind of cool. And you get that effect. The virtue of it is that. Okay. We'll talk about it more. So here are the four qualities. When you get close to the end of the Geshe course in the monastery, you know, you've been studying all these different subjects, and then you get close to the end, and you suddenly, as I mentioned, you see, you start to realize that this is one, like, big, I want to say plot, what's the word? What's another word? There's another word for that. Conspiracy, yeah. It's one big conspiracy. I mean, all these different things, you know, you start when you're like 13 years old, they start teaching you formal syllogisms. What is a good logical reason? And it's like, for a 13-year-old, it's pretty boring stuff. And then they go through all this stuff about outline of existence, causation, the idea of negation and positives. Then they get into Buddhist psychology. Then they go into this long, long, long things about all these other subjects, Prajnaparamita. Then all these subjects about Madhyamika, all these non-Buddhist schools. Then they go through the other three lower schools. They go through the third and a half school. They go through all these years and years and years of study. And you're getting all these seemingly unrelated teachings. And then suddenly, after about 15 years, it's like, boom, something hits you in your mind. And you say, oh my God, it's all a big conspiracy. You know, it's all connected. Everything is connected, you know. Everything is totally interconnected. And they all have their own place and they're all complementing each other. And you see that there's not a single teaching that you ever had in 15 years which in the slightest way doesn't totally fit like a crossword puzzle in with all the other teachings. And they all, some genius has set up this monastic course and it all like, basically it was just on Kappa. And they all just fit like this very, very intricate puzzle. And then you suddenly see the whole picture for the first time. And it's just incredible. What it happens in your mind is you gain this appreciation. It doesn't mean that, for example, the lower schools don't say things which the higher schools don't accept. They do say things which the higher schools don't accept. But who taught them? The Buddha taught them all. Why does the Buddha teach a lower school that says things that the higher schools don't accept? It's to get you along a little bit further. You will find in your career, when you start teaching people, that, for example, when you teach emptiness, certain people won't be able to, you can't lay the Diamond Cutter Sutra on for 10 days on someone who's just fresh. You can't do it. It won't help them. They won't get it. They'll be frustrated. Something will happen wrong. You know, you need to start, you know, doing these, talk about causation and how things are interconnected and things like that. You have to start like that. That's the idea of the four schools. But once you master the four schools, you'll see that they're all consistent with each other. Totally, totally perfect interlocking puzzle that is all designed to get anyone to the goal of enlightenment. And you really appreciate that. If you study the Long Rim, it'll come to you how the Long Rim has all of that in it. There's no subject that we've studied in the last 4 or 5 years that you won't find in the Long Rim that doesn't have its place somewhere in that ladder called the Long Rim. And you'll suddenly it'll dawn on you, oh man, you know, this is all, this whole 5-year thing, each rung on the ladder is all interconnected and it all has a place. It has its own place.
Okay.
We've been typing in Buddhist books in the computer in India with a couple, you know, in 15 monasteries now for 10 years. And we've input like 100,000 pages now. We have finished 11% of the canon. We have not finished any percent of the Tibetan commentary. I don't think we've finished 1% yet. It'll take another 100 years or 200 years to input all of the sacred texts. But you can take that database as it exists now in a laptop and you can search for some idea, or you can just almost type something in at random and you can let it do the search program, go through and it'll make hits through the 100,000 pages. And depending on how rare what you're hitting is, it might hit 5 times in 100,000 pages. It hits like 5 times. And you can take that sentence, if that's all you see, you can take that sentence and if you reach a certain point in your study, which you can either go through a Geshe course for 15, 16 years, or study Lam Rim, and you will immediately see, oh yeah, that's that place in my practice. You know, I'm supposed to do that in that part of my practice. That relates to that part of my personal practice. You know, and it's incredible. Once you get to that point, which you can do if you just learn the Lam Rim well for the next 3, 2.5 classes, it'll immediately say, oh yeah, I know where that fits into my practice. I know where I know that fits into meditation number 4 that I'm supposed to do. That's Lam Rim number 4. that fits in right there. And what I'm saying is that once you get a good grasp of the Lam Rim, the whole structure of Buddhism, you could take a search program, you could hit any sentence in 100,000 pages, and you would immediately know where it relates to your personal meditation. It's very cool. That's the quality of the Lam Rim. Once you study Lam Rim, you have that overview of the whole Buddhist teachings. Because otherwise it's kind of frustrating. I mean, you can sit with Ken Rinpoche and learn for 30 years and you don't see any kind of, he's not slowing down, you know what I mean? What he knows, and there's nothing, there's this joke, Steve Foster came to him in 1974 and said, you know, how long is it going to take, Rinpoche? And he says, 20 years. Ask me in 20 years, okay? And Steve says, yeah, right, you know. So 20 years later, this joke, Steve Foster came to him and said, how much farther are we going to go, you know? Because he's not even slowing down, you know. I mean, the things that you never heard of, that he knows, he's still revealing things, you know, and still hasn't gotten to a lot of things. And you're like, you know, the Buddhist teachings are vast and very profound, but if you study the Lam Rim well, there isn't one sentence that you will ever learn that you won't know exactly where it fits into your personal meditations. And that's the quality of the Lam Rim. There's also this quality that if the relationship with the Lama is going well, and if it's clicking, then the thing that you most need next and the thing that you are wondering about comes up in the next class or something, you know? I mean, that's a sign that the relationship is going well, and you know, exactly what you were curious about and exactly what you needed to know and exactly what you needed for your own practice came to you personally in the next moment, you know? And it's just the quality, if the Lam Rim is flowing the right way, it happens like that. Number three, Ngewe Gomba Dewa Nyepan Dong. And this third one easily grasps the intent of the Buddha. You know, as you go through Buddhist scripture and as you read different subjects and as you get different teachings, if you've studied the Lam Rim well, if you have a good basis in Lam Rim, and Lam Rim Dudin is enough, you know, this little Lam Rim is enough, you will know exactly, you'll be able to figure out very, very easily, why did the Buddha teach this particular teaching? You know, why did the Buddha get into this? You know, why did the Buddha go through 24 kinds of syllogisms? You know, I mean, what's the point? And it's, you'll immediately be able to grasp why. You know, for example, the whole purpose of Buddhist logic is very interesting. It's to learn not to judge others. I mean, you have to study syllogisms for like 6 years to figure out that you don't know what other people are thinking when they act the way they do. You know, it takes 6 years of studying syllogisms to really grasp that you don't know why other people are doing what they do. They could have all sorts of sacred thoughts in their mind when they do things. How do you know? I mean, you come to a place where you know by studying every kind of corner of logic that exists in the world that you cannot logically know. You can't judge other people. Period. You know, I can prove it to you logically. You know, and you can go through all this logic and suddenly you realize, oh, that's why the Buddha taught logic. And the opening lines of these incredibly detailed, intricate logic to books are don't judge other people if you're not like me. This is the Buddha. Because you will screw up. You know, he's very adamant. You know, and that's the opening of the logic text. In other words, every little thing you study, you will understand easily why did the Buddha teach that. I mean, you'll grasp all these things very easily. It's a virtue of the Lam Rim. If you really study Lam Rim well, any scripture you ever study will just blow your mind. And you'll just suddenly see, oh, yeah, that's the point. That's how it relates to my personal practice. And that's why the Buddha taught it. Okay? Nothing will seem to you to be a waste of time. Nothing will seem to you to be something that's not very important. Okay? That's exactly what the Tibetan says. Okay? Saves you from the great abyss. The great abyss is this. It's to say that particular Buddhist teaching is stupid. You know, that particular part of the of Buddhism, of Buddhist scripture. I don't see any point to it. I don't see that it's true. I don't see that it has any relevance to modern man. You know, I think it's kind of superfluous. I don't know why they're spending so much time on that right now. That doesn't strike me as very cool. We had a classic example. We sent Nagarjuna Sudhaleka. We translated it and we sent it to a very major publisher on the West Coast. And we got this letter back saying, could you spice up the emptiness and cut the morality part? You know? So like, we're supposed to improve on Nagarjuna, you know? We're supposed to edit Nagarjuna from modern times. Because the morality part doesn't seem to be relevant, you know? That's the Yangtze Chenpo. That's the great abyss. And if you study the Lamrim nicely, like if we studied the Diamond Cutter Sutra, the way we studied it, you really, really see why an ethical way of life is totally, perfectly helpful and useful and necessary. Because what? Because things are empty. Okay, I mean, and that's a great insight, and that takes Lamrim. You have to know the Lamrim. You know, and to think that you must act like a crazy bodhisattva. Your life must be totally irrationally giving and loving and taking care of other people first because things are empty. You know, I mean, you have to appreciate every single corner of the Buddhist teachings. They all have a place, they're all helping each other, they're all supporting each other. Does it mean that you're supposed to accept things that you can't accept right now? Absolutely not. We've been through that many times. As a Buddhist, you're not allowed to accept something just because the guy got up there and said it. You are not allowed to do that. You're a lousy Buddhist if you do that. You're a stupid Buddhist. There's even a word for it, depijena. You're a stupid Buddhist. If you just accept it because the person up there said it. Because then if the guy gets up tomorrow and says the opposite, you'll do that too. So it has to be reasonable to you. It has to be acceptable to you. It has to make sense to you. But the point here is, if it doesn't make sense right now, don't reject it. Just shelve it. There's a beautiful line from Maitreya where he says, I know that you can't accept everything I say. So take the thing you can't buy yet and just leave it. But don't make the great mistake of rejecting it. Don't say, I don't like this part, or this part's not written so well, or this part's not so interesting, or this part seems irrelevant, or this part was okay for historical India, we don't need to act like that nowadays. He was just writing that for ancient India, you know. I mean, things like that, ideas like that. If you hold that kind of viewpoint, you've fallen into the great abyss. If you study the Lamrim, even just a three-class Lamrim, even the shortest Lamrim ever written, you won't make that mistake. Sometimes they call it the great mistake. You know, you won't reject offhand, you know, something. You'll see that everything has its own place in that beautiful... Think of it as a big ball of light made up of pins of light, pinpoints of light, and each one of them has its place in the whole structure. By the time you reach your end of Buddhist study, you will start to see the whole setup like that as one huge network of light. And every teaching you ever got... By the way, there's a place in the path of preparation, Jorlam, where you reach a kind of samadhi, where you remember every single teaching you ever had, as direct as day. You know, every single teaching you've ever had, you know, comes back to you and takes its place in this huge, it's called Shujingin Tingenzin. You remember the stream of your memory goes back infinitely far, and you remember all the teachings you ever had. And they all take their place in this huge, beautiful ball of light, you know, and it'll come like that. So the Lamrim gives you a taste of that. And if you study the Lamrim, it keeps you out of making the mistake of rejecting some of those lights, just because you can't see the connection yet. The vision of the connection is made by studying the Lamrim. And those are the qualities of the Lamrim. Those are the four qualities of the Lamrim. That's about it.